Thebeatgeek.com's official podcast.
Here we go. Sitting with me today is Sergeant John Katsaros, U.S. Army Air Force. Escaped the Gestapo during World War II, and here he is sitting right next to me, and he's going to give a brief introduction of himself.
Yes, my name is John Katsaros. I come from Havel, Massachusetts, and I was with the 8th Air Force in England on a 4th Bomb Group, 612 Squadron, 94th Wing, and the 1st Division. And I was stationed in Deanthorpe, England, and we were bombing Germany out of England.
Great. So, what was your opinion of the military before the Pearl Harbor attack? Were you interested in joining? What were your motives? Were you more economically motivated to join the military? What was the main motive?
Well, we were in a position where we knew that the world was going to be in war, and we would be in there very shortly. Mm-hmm. And the amazing thing happened. I had a grocery store, and 6 months before Pearl Harbor, there was two magazines named Collier's Magazine and the Life Magazine. Very popular magazine was the Life, was my favorite. And both magazines had a caption in front of the six months before Pearl Harbor. It stated, Pearl Harbor is impregnable. And the other one said, impregnable Pearl Harbor. Wow. So the stories were written up on it. I got the Collier's Magazine, and it's in my book. I can't find the Life Magazine with a battleship roll. In the front page, in color, 6 months before Pearl Harbor, I said, what are they trying to do? I said, they're giving the Japanese an idea how to bomb this place, and that's what happened.
Interesting. So you had firsthand knowledge in the newspaper of perhaps Pearl Harbor's a potential target, and we are defended there. And it was shocking to you when it got attacked. And you, what was the feeling when you saw that?
The feeling was that I was wondering if the aircraft carriers were there, because that was very important during the war, because that's where the airplanes would be flying out of. They'd be flying out of islands, would be too far away. But yep. Being an aircraft carrier, they could get close to the island. And luckily, they had the 4 aircraft carriers out to sea. So there must have been some knowledge that that was going to happen. In fact, they knew it was going to happen eventually, but they didn't know that it was going to happen on that day. Mm-hmm. The Japanese are famous of doing things like this on a Sunday, especially because they did an attack once against Turkey. It was Russia.
Okay.
Russia. And they did it on a Sunday. And they did it as a surprise visit. And it was too bad whatever happened. We lost too many good men and played.
So it was a big surprise. And let's see. So you decided to join up.
What happened right then and there, I knew I had to join up.
Yep.
And the next day I went to the post office in Haverhill, Massachusetts. And I told them I wanted to join the Naval Air Force. I wanted to become an air cadet and fly a fighter. And they said, come back tomorrow because we've got too many people here.
Uh-huh.
They gave me a number. They went back the next day. And there was 27 of us. We all joined up at the same time.
From your town?
That's right.
Wow.
But some of them joined the Army, some joined the Navy, some joined the Air Force. I joined the Naval Air Cadet.
Right.
So now I became a Naval Air Cadet, and I took my tests in Havel and passed them all, my physicals and so forth. I went to Boston right after that, and on Causeway Street in Boston, they had a naval station there. I had to take board tests and so forth, and they told me to go home because they had so many people joining, they didn't have a place to put
them. Amazing.
You, I waited my time for a couple of 3 months, and at that time I was working at the Portsmouth Navy Yard. I was running a crane up there, and I was a senior in Haverhill High School, and I was only...
And you joined up when you were 20 years old, correct?
No, I joined up when I was 18.
And then the incident we're talking about mainly happened when you were 20, the big one.
Oh, I'll get into that quickly.
Right.
But anyway, what happened when they called me in again, and sure enough, there was 10 of us, and they gave us a test and physicals again, a third time, and passed them all. They put us in the bus, and they're going to bus us down to Florida, and we're going to go down and become air cadets. So right away, a staff officer, a naval staff officer, walked into the bus. So wait a minute. I have one more test, everybody. It's an Ishihara test. So with Ishihara test. Now, if you go to an ophthalmologist, you ask him about that. And the Ishihara test is a booklet that has several pages in it. And there's a round circle with various kinds of dots. And
you
have to read the numbers in those dots. 7 out of 10 men cannot read those dots.
And that's because, the requirement to become an air cadet.
Yes, because you're going to land in an airplane. You're going to land.
And the instruments are so precise and all the different requirements of flying.
Especially if you're landing on an aircraft carrier.
Right.
Imagine if you've got a red flag up there and it's a maroon flag. It may look brown to you.
Yep, colors are important.
I'm going to say what they did to us before we went in. They had yarn. Little butts of yarn. They say pick a white, pick a blue, pick a brown. And there's nothing to that. But when you get into the shades of brown, now you're not colorblind, but you have a color perception problem.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Interesting. Yeah. So you were having difficulties with that.
Yes.
Unfortunately.
They threw us out of the Navy.
So this changed your course of which service to join in your decision making.
And right away, the U.S. Army Air Force was waiting for us.
Awesome.
And you know why they were waiting for us? Because we could see through camouflage.
Nice.
We could be at 30,000 feet and could see a German plane taking off in camouflage at his air base. And we could say, hey, they're coming up from that air base.
What, looks so like you had good vision. Just couldn't pass the
simple
test.
Good vision.
Yeah. All right. Okay. So then after the unfortunate test, you couldn't become an air cadet pilot. You couldn't join the naval air services on the aircraft carriers.
That's
right. So, you chose the Army grabbed you. Explain that.
And they sent us to Fort Devens.
Fort Devens.
They gave you more tests.
More tests. Okay.
I was lucky. My brother was a school teacher, and he said, "When you get to Fort Devens, he went into service before me, and he became a colonel at the end of the war." But he says, these are some of the questions that they're going to give you, but there'll be variations, but you got to know what's going to happen. That gave me a big help because, sure enough, they had a test, but it was a different test than he had, and I passed it with flying colors. So right away, they shipped us down to Miami Beach, and that's where we had our basic training.
Wow, so you now live part-time in South Florida?
Yes.
So that's part of the love you got from in the past visiting here?
That's right.
That's why you picked this place?
That's right.
Great.
Yeah.
So I live near John. I've lived around him for a little while. He knows me well. And so let's discuss now the journey over to Germany and the whole process of being, you're now in the Air Cadet, you're now in the Air Force, U.S. Army, you're U.S. Army Air Force, Sergeant.
Not a cadet. No. I was sent to Fort Myers after basic training, and I learned to be an aerial gunner. Then they sent me to Seymour Johnson Field, North Carolina. I learned to be an aerial engineer. And then they shipped me to Salt Lake City, and that's where they assigned me to Pio, Texas, and that's where I met my group that I had to fly with. So now I was in a B-17, and training as a gunner. And I was being trained as an engineer. That would be a person that could actually start the plane and
prepare the plane for the engineer.
Fill up with gasoline. You have to check everything.
Did these planes have in-air refueling at the time?
Oh, you refuel it in combat. What you do is you take the plane and you put it in line to take off with the other bombers.
Wow.
So now you stop the motors. And then you fill the tanks up again right to the brim.
From the plane? From you?
No, you had to get on the wing of the plane, and that's where the...
Wow, so this was before they had the the refueling you know nowadays.
This was
John going out on the wing and filling up the plane's tank. Amazing.
Gasoline, right?
So, all right. So now you're getting to your major training of what you actually experienced in the war. This was the training.
What happens? They had a first phase training in Pyle, Texas. Second phase training in Dallas, Texas.
What was the timeline of your whole training?
That was it.
Okay.
What happened is this. By the time we got into second phase training, the 8th Air Force was having a lot of problems because they started flying bombing missions into Germany. Before that, they were flying into France, and it was a quick mission, and they had protection from Spitfires, British Spitfires, American P-38s and P-47s, yep. But they didn't have the P-51, which could go a further area.
So what happened?
So finally, what happened is a couple of missions. One was in Oschersleben, Germany. At Oschersleben, they hit a factory, and there was 62 planes that got shot down there. 62
Allied planes,
bombers. 10 men in
from ground, or were they Spitfire planes?
They lost about 40% of 88 aircraft, ACAG guns they called, and the others were with ME-109 German planes and Fokker 90, two great planes that the Germans had.
So this was a wide awakening for the air services of the U.S. Armed Forces. So they needed to change strategy.
A week later, same thing happened in Schweinfurt. And in my book, you'll see a picture of Schweinfurt that was taken by somebody, not me, because I was not on that mission, right? But I thought I got it in there because you could see the bomb, the ACAC coming up. And when you flew in ACAC, the Germans had excellent people that could figure it out. And I'll tell you later on the story how they did it.
Yep.
But we had to... Right after that, the RAF, the Royal Air Force, wanted us...
Right after the second incident of major aircraft being shot down?
They devastated the 8th Air Force.
Okay.
They lost all their planes. They lost 120-some-odd planes. 20% of the planes that went back never flew again. They had dead people on those planes.
Oh, my God.
It was a disaster. So this time they went out there. 620 men were shot down, killed, or wounded.
Yep.
The next time, it was 6,200, right? It was 1,200, 200 men.
Skilled airmen.
And then you had dead people on a plane coming back, and the planes couldn't fly again. They didn't have any planes left, and they had no crews left.
All right.
So they cut our mission, and they told us, go to Nebraska, pick up a plane. So they split my crew in half. We took two planes and flew them to England.
The B-17s?
Yeah, two B-17s. We took them, we flew them right up there. Detroit, from Detroit, we went to... It was supposed to go to Prescott, Maine.
So we were getting kind of destroyed in the airfield.
Yeah.
And here comes B-17s over there. Okay, so let's just take it... You're taken off in the mission we're talking about.
Okay, well, what happened? Then we flew from there. We flew to Grand and Newfoundland, and then we ended up in... Prescott, Scotland. Then they took us and brought us down to our air base, which was in Deanthorpe, the 4th Bomb Group, as I mentioned before. And then the first mission, just prior to that, the British wanted us to join with them. And there was a big meeting with Churchill, Roosevelt, and so forth.
Yep.
And they got together.
And Stalin, right?
Stalin wasn't there, no.
Oh, okay. Who was it?
No. It was when? Churchill.
Churchill and Roosevelt, okay.
And all the, it was General Aker and General, all the generals that we
all
had.
All the Allies.
And then the British had their generals. And while they were talking to us about trying to join that, the British had their Lancaster bombers go out on a mission, and they lost 91 of them.
Okay. So now things are getting a little iffy.
Right away. They wanted us to fly night missions because that's what they did. They would fly one behind the other, and we would fly in a formation.
So you're hearing this.
Yeah.
Oh, you're ready to go.
Okay, now.
Sort of.
So now they decided hey, leave the ace of first alone. So what happened on our first mission? We got up there, and we were supposed to go to Frankfurt.
Okay. And how old are you on the first mission?
Yeah, that's first mission.
How old are you?
I was about 18.
Wow.
Just not quite 19.
Great.
Yeah, 90 years old, I flew most of my missions.
Cool.
And what happened is that, it was the first time I saw a German plane. And what happened, the pilot called up, and I was the assistant engineer that day. And I was flying a right waist position with a gun.
Right wing position with a gun, yeah.
Yeah, I got a 50 caliber machine gun.
Yep.
And Johnny, my pilot said, John, he's coming up right by you. This plane came by me, and I'll show you in the booklet that I have.
Great. You see, I'll link
this. 4490. It came right by me, right in front, never took a shot at us. And I aimed at the front of the plane, and I blew the whole tail end off.
So one of his first experiences in air was blowing the tail off a German. What kind of plane was it?
It was a Fokker 490.
Fokker 490?
I called up the tail gunner. The tail gunner says, look, I can't see what happened. Did the pilot bail out? He said, yeah, the pilot bailed out. So I got to kill. But I didn't kill them. I didn't want to kill the pilot. See?
Mm-hmm. So we took down the plane successfully. That's pretty
unbelievable, right?
Yeah, wow.
So now all of a sudden, we call him. It was my job as sergeant. Control all the other sergeants. So I would call for an oxygen check, because now you're flying around 35,000 feet.
That's important.
And where does oxygen begin and stop? What altitude? 10,000 feet.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're up 25,000 feet above 10, so you need an oxygen tank. And every 4 or 5 minutes I say oxygen check, it starts from the pilot all the way to the tail gunner. The tail gunner never answered. So the pilot says, go back and check it. He had passed out because he was firing his two guns. He was slashing around like that, and the oxygen mask came off. He didn't realize it.
Good shot.
Now, when you're off oxygen, you don't know that. But you stay off it about a minute, you'll die.
Mm-hmm.
So I put the oxygen mask back on him again, and he kept fighting me when he started to take the life, because that's what happens.
You lose consciousness.
Yeah, I fought it, and I'm sucking up all the oxygen, and so was he. In the back of the plane, because for me to get it back in the plane,
right.
I have to get off my oxygen and get a little tank like that that's held 10 minutes of oxygen in it.
And you're wrestling
on me and crawl back to him. And
so this was a midair emergency after the kill.
This was the first mission.
Unbelievable.
So
there are details.
I got back to life again, but we ran out of oxygen. We had to run to the front of the plane and hook up these 10-minute bottles. So the rest of the people in the back could have enough oxygen.
Cool. So that's the first mission.
That's the first mission.
Well, anyway, kill saved a sergeant's life.
I'm going to talk to you about my missions.
Exactly. So this is awesome so far. It's gone 18 minutes. 30 minutes is fine. I'm sure we can handle that. So your first mission, you landed after this?
Yeah, everybody was
in
good shape.
In Scotland?
Intelligence will sit you down and they say, okay, let us know what happened. Now you're over Germany. They want to know everything that happened over there. How many planes came at you? How many bombs they hit? And, you know, who got shot down? Do you see any bombs?
So you sat down with Army intelligence and explained.
Yeah, and then you say, well, I saw a B-17 go down such and such a spot, and I saw three parachutes. I couldn't see any more. Anybody else could see it?
No. So you did see an Allied plane go down in this mission?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, okay.
And then what happened is that the tail gunner says, hey, John, aren't you going to tell them about the plane you shot down? So when you get there, this is an experience. I want to put you into it.
Okay.
Now, you're fighting a war for 7 hours, right? And you're going in and coming back. It's taking you 3-4 hours to fly to them. It takes maybe 10, 11, 12 hours for the whole mission.
Uh-huh.
Now you're in England and everything's quiet, right?
Right.
And you just climb up, you know?
Just like a
dream, you know? So I said, well, he says, did you shoot somebody down? So that's when somebody handed me a double shot of scotch.
Oh, wow. That'll tune you out of your dreams. Get you back down there.
A double shot of scotch. And the radio man didn't drink. And he hands over me. And from that day out, after drinking scotch, I never stopped talking.
Great. Anyway, so that was the first successful mission. And then here we go. We're taking off again. How long after this mission?
Well, I went to building once and I had to fly in with a replacement group.
Uh-huh.
And this poor pilot didn't know how to fly in formation. You had to fly formation because you could get more gunners shooting at the German plane from different places.
Elevator. Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's right.
Because so depending on where the plane altitudes is, you can attack more planes at this altitude.
Another gunner down there can shoot.
Right, so from
another gunner down below can shoot.
That so this pilot had a little trouble with it. Your pilot.
That pilot, you got to give him a lot of credit.
Right on. That's okay, right, yeah, exactly.
You fly the planes, you can almost touch the wing of the next plane.
Right.
You can almost touch it. That's how close they had to fly. And you ought to give credit to do that.
Understood.
I could fly a B-17, he taught me, but he never taught me to fly in formation.
Yep.
And never taught me to land it, and never taught me to take off of it.
So let's give him some credit. This pilot, yeah, definitely. So this was another mission. Is this the mission?
Well, the mission I want to talk about would be the one that we got shot down on.
Right.
And that was our 11th mission.
11th mission.
We went to Berlin twice. And just to give you a little quick story, the pilot of that plane was too scared to fly close. And I'd say to him, I've been on 7 missions now, and there's 10 men on the plane, and he's maybe 100 yards behind the closest plane.
Mm-hmm.
And he's flying the last plane in formation. They called it Purple Heart Corner. You know why? That was the first plane that the Germans would shoot down, because he was too far back.
In the formation, this was the...
Only one gun might be shooting at the plane instead of 6 or 7 guns.
Right.
You know? Because you're not in formation.
Right.
So I called up and I said, we're over the English Channel. We could be attacked right here.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't you get your plane a little closer? So then he did. Next day, I know he's back again. But so you having trouble with an engine or anything like that? Because we're over France now, and they're going to come up. I can see them coming up now.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, Sergeant, if you'll keep quiet, I'm going to have you court-martial. I said, get that goddamn plane in there. I'll come and fire. All of a sudden, the German plane came over and shot right through the radio operator, missed the radio operator, and you could see all the holes. It looked like cheesecake.
You saw this.
Right?
You saw the bullets in the plane.
Right next to it.
How much in the plane
right
could
that,
you see?
He went right that, right in there quick. He went all the way to Berlin and back again. Never get out of formation.
I got you.
I went out of my hands and knees, and he came up and tapped me. He said, I want to apologize to you, Sergeant. I said, I accept the apologies, but don't worry. You became a combat pilot today. It takes most pilots 7 missions to learn to fly the way you fly.
Yep.
That was it.
Awesome. So you got a lot of respect for him, and he got respect for you.
Oh, sure.
Do you remember his name?
Yeah. No.
Yep, I understand. I understand. It's in the book, probably.
And the thing is, though, the mission you'd like to hear about would be the last mission.
And your story
of escape. 20th of March, 1944.
Great. 20th of March, 1944. From what I understand, 1945 was the atomic bomb. In 1945, during that year, was the storming of Normandy.
I was 44.
44 was the storming 44. Of Normandy. And your incident was June 20th of March.
20th of March. This is
20th of March 44, and Normandy was
June 6, 1944.
Got it. So right before Normandy.
Yeah. And what happened is, so we took off at a base. The weather was terrible. We flew all the way to Germany. We couldn't hold formation, bouncing all over the sky. And what happened? We were going to Frankfurt that day too, and we got close to the area with
deep in the enemy lines.
Oh yeah, way back.
Yeah.
And we had no fighter coverage.
Okay.
Because we didn't have a fight P-51s that had the build an engine in. It was a British Navy.
So where did you take off from?
We would take off from England.
England, and we flying would fly over France?
We fly over the English Channel to France, and then we also the
north to Germany.
Right through to Germany.
And scan the skies.
Right. Now we
protect the Europeans.
We bombing all, we jumped all over the sky, and what happened, a plane above us lost its control and came down, almost hit us. My pilot went into a dive, and we were up against the wall of the plane because you're in centrifugal force.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't think the pilot was going to pull it off, but he did. That guy should have got the Purple Heart for doing that, because if that plane had ever hit us, he could have taken down maybe 500 or 600 planes.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
And so there was multiple incidents during. There was multiple incidents that were amazing.
So we went up, and we went up to where we were. We flying at around 35,000 feet.
Yep.
So we get up there, and there's not another plane in sight. Mm-hmm. Because of radio silence, we couldn't find out why. Where were they gone? What happened to them? So we thought they went right into the target, Frankfurt. Now we go into Frankfurt, and the weather opens up in Frankfurt.
Oh, wow.
And the sun is shining nice.
You could see the ground.
And we're the only plane over to Frankfurt.
Oh, my goodness.
And my bombardier hit that target, 92% damage. And you see...
Successful bombing of a Frankfurt Nazi encampment.
They don't even report on the 20th of March.
Okay.
So if you see a report, you'll see a report that the 8th Air Force bombed Frankfurt, Germany at 92% accuracy.
Right on.
It doesn't say it was one plane, though. Right?
Yeah.
They cover that stuff. Well, anyway, we got over Frankfurt. He hits the target. The ACAT hits two of our engines. The two inboard engines.
The anti-aircraft hit two of the engines.
And engines quit. But the B-17 was built strong. It was a strong plane. Yeah. You could take a screwdriver, you could put it right through the skin of the plane because it was that thin, right? But when you get a lot of damage on it, you could have thousands of holes in the plane and it's still flying.
Wow.
As long as you get the engines working, and sometimes even one engine working, I'll tell you, many times guys came back and when they got to their field, they had one engine, and sometimes that engine would cut out, and they'd fly it right in.
So after the bombing of Frankfurt, then
so now what happens is the German Air Force comes after us.
Right.
And six ME-109 planes started after us, and they started shooting after us. The first phase that came through, the engineer got hit in the neck with a 20-millimeter cannon, and his head was blown off. It ended up, according to the pilot, in the bomb bay.
Wow. So the engineer in the plane got his head blown off by German plane.
He was the first guy that was killed.
So after the bombing, they were under attack by German planes, navigated to safer skies where they could have support from other Allied aircraft.
There was no support. We were all alone.
Okay, so they were alone after this bombing in Frankfurt. And they went south towards France.
That's right.
Being chased by Germans.
That's right. All the way from Frankfurt, we're going across Germany, and we didn't want to get shot down, but we were running out of ammunition.
Mm-hmm.
By this time, almost everybody that played had got shot. Mm-hmm. I got hit.
Where were you hit, John?
I was flying. Again, I was flying the right waist position.
Yep.
Right. Thank God I was, because if I was the engineer that day, I wouldn't have had a hit.
So you were hitting the...
What happened?
Shoulder?
I got hit in the legs first.
Okay.
The legs, yeah. And what happened is that I looked at the tail gun position and a guy slumped over. So I had run out of ammunition. So I ran back to help him and he died in my arms.
Mm.
He got hit with a rocket right here in his stomach. And he just bled to death right in my arms. A plane was coming right at me, and he had several bullets in his 50 caliber shell with two guns. So I aimed right straight at that plane, because he didn't even fire at us. He must have been out of ammunition, or he was coming close to knock us down, I blew him right out of the sky.
So another kill by drone.
But this guy didn't.
Wow.
This guy didn't.
Got the pilot.
I didn't care because I think he was the guy that killed my
gunner. Understood.
And I ran back to the waist. He was dead. The engineer was dead. There's two people dead in the plane, right? The guy next to me, left waist gunner, got hit in the neck. And he was bleeding. I took a scarf and put it around him quickly. But it was so cold up there, 60 to 70 below zero. The blood congealed, just like that, into a ball of blood. And we put a parachute on him. I opened up.
Two people you ended up helping out of the skies, right?
We helped a lot of people.
Right.
Yeah. And I was getting help from the radio man only, because he was the only one in the back of the plane with me. The ball turret man hadn't got out yet. He was still firing away. And
I can see the memories in your eyes now. So, I mean,
this is all ridiculous. It's just quick, you know, everything's going quick.
Right, so you're in the sky.
So now, the radio man puts his parachute on the guy, and we threw him out of the plane, and he owned it, the poor guy, and he lived for 2 days in a German hospital. Mm. But by this time, we were over France, and we didn't want to bail out over Germany, because if you land in the farmhouse, the farmer could come out and pitchfork you to death.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't let you live if you lived it.
Unbelievable. So then the Nazis had almost full support of the Germans somehow.
So now we went into France and we were heading for Reims and the plane catch fire. The wing catch fire. When the wing catches fire, you got to get out of that plane quickly.
That's where the gas is.
The gas is, right? And it's flaming. And the pilot says, everybody out of the plane. And we had no communications with the pilot. But the bombardier threw the navigator out, who got badly injured. He couldn't put his parachute on, but his parachute never opened up. And the kid saw him come down, and he died hit the floor from 27,500 feet.
How many people in the plane survived?
Ten people in the plane.
Immediate survival.
Three dead already.
Okay.
And the fourth guy died, the left waist gunner died 2 days later. Now there's just the ball turret operator, the radio man, and me left in the plane.
Three.
And the ball turret operator started coming out of his plane. We're trying to get our parachutes on, and it was hard to put it on, because we had been shot. So he got stuck in a ball turret. He couldn't come out. Can you imagine what's going through his mind? No pilot, automatic pilot, fire. The pilot's flown out, bailed out. The co-pilot's bailed out.
So there's three left in the plane.
Two guys that can help him.
Two guys.
Yeah. So we looked down, and he had a gearbox. So he could turn that thing around 360 degrees. The gearbox, if you put your arms around it, two times around it, it was bigger than that. And there was a lot of empty shells in there. Because we had about 1,000 empty shells on the floor of the plane.
And what did that become useful for? The empty shells, just...
The empty shells.
That's interesting, just...
So they just fell on the floor as we were shooting, you know? And boom, 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 they by. And then when we walked, we just slipped and slide over all that.
Yeah, it's just a mess.
And so we went over there and plucked the stuff out. And when he came out of the plane, he was so excited that he got out. He picked up his parachute. They picked it up by the D-ring, and it opened up.
Oh, no.
What could happen to that poor guy?
Oh, my God.
He was shot, this and that. So he puts it around his hands, and he bails out 25,000
with it attached wrong, because he couldn't, because he popped it soon.
Yeah. Now, we knew enough, like we were trained, if that happens, you bail out, and you know you're going to pass out when you're coming down. So don't let your arms go. Hold on to it and pray that thing will open up when your arms drop as you wake up. And his parachute opened up, but he was unconscious almost all the way down. And when he got down almost to landing, his parachute got stuck in it, got caught in a high tension wire, and he fell down. He got been hurt pretty badly. The Germans picked him up and put him in the hospital for 57 days and saved his life. In the meantime,
so Germans were a little bit, in the place Germans too. Did treat our downed soldiers. The Germans did treat our downed soldiers with some sort of respect.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
We treated them with respect.
Yeah. And if you landed with the Gestapo or something like that.
Different story.
But if you landed with the doctors around, they would try to help you.
Interesting.
And if you landed with the Luftwaffe, which is the German Air Force, they would also help you. Because we said, we will help you when you land in our area. You help us in our area. That's what they did.
So it seems like the young men really...
The Luftwaffe, the German Luftwaffe, were not Nazis.
Interesting.
They wouldn't salute this way. They saluted this way.
That's different story.
That's a good thing. They hated Hitler.
Interesting. So here we are. Three guys on the plane. One got out.
There's only two left.
John and his friend.
So the radio man came up, and with his left hand, because he was shot in the right hand after that. Well, we were helping the tail gunner.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the ball turret. We both got hit in the right arm, and we couldn't even use it.
So you were still getting shot at while you were helping him?
Huh?
You were still getting shot at while you were helping him?
Yeah.
Okay.
So anyway, what happened is that and he took his left arm, and I took my left arm, and he clipped his parachute on, and he clipped my parachute
nice.
On that way. See? Now, we had to take a free fall, too.
And this is at 20 years old. How old was your friend?
I was 20 then.
Yep.
So now, when you know enough, when you bail out, you kind of just fall out.
You just fall out. You bundle up and fall out of the plane.
If you stand up, you got to hit the end of the plane to get killed.
Right.
Right? So that's what we did. What do you do before that? Say a prayer.
Yeah.
You say a prayer. And you believe that you want somebody else's help.
Mm-hmm.
Now I wake up finally, I'm way down. I'm coming down. You're going down about...
So he's in midair over France.
Yeah.
What town in France?
Fribes.
Fribes, France.
Fribes, France, right.
Okay, so what I know is he ended up on a runway. Go ahead,
John. That's right.
Good. And I also got one other guy random to buy your book.
So anyway,
we'll talk about the book later.
All right. And then what happened is that when I woke up, I prayed again because I couldn't raise my right hand because the D-ring was right here.
So waking up on the ground.
So now I'm
waking up in the air.
Left hand over. I just barely got it in with my fingertips.
In air.
And I pulled it. I was still close to the ground.
Okay.
And whack! And the parachute opened because you're coming down hundreds of miles an hour.
And you're in thick air now, low.
Yeah. And I broke six ribs.
The parachute strap broke six of his ribs.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because of the
pulse. He can handle it. He's fine.
Yeah. And then I hit the ground. Fractured this ankle through places, fractured the ankle in one place. I cut my head off.
Describe the landing in briefly. Describe the initial landing briefly.
I landed at an Air Force, French World War One Air Force base.
Was it in use?
Huh?
Was it in use?
Not in use.
It was just privately used, probably.
Yeah, it was owned by people by the name of Chavon. What happened is, we all landed right on the runway.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody that bailed out. And there's a French researcher that flew an airplane, found out exactly where we landed. And we get it in a book, you can see it.
Cool.
Anyway, everybody should read that book.
I agree, I'll say it now. Code Burgundy, The Long Escape by John Katsaros. He wrote it himself almost entirely. And it's his true story. You can get it on johnkatsaros.com. And we'll just briefly touch on his escape in France.
Yeah.
So after you buy his book.
I was a German plane flew over me. And then one and I might have been the guy that shot us down.
So a German plane flew over and was looking at his position, gave the position away. Yep.
Yeah. And the Gestapo came over. But actually, I could see the... the pilot's face as he came by and saluted me.
And I interesting. Moved
left-handed because he was coming this way. So I couldn't use my right hand. So I used my left. I saluted him. He came over three times. Each time he came
that
over.
That salute might have saved your life.
Yeah. So that's why I say about the Luftwaffe.
Right on.
Yeah. And the Gestapo picked me up. And they brought me to the farmhouse. And I was there for two or three days. And they kept questioning me. I'm going to give an answer. Name, rank, serial number. Then the third day, they brought a doctor, a German doctor. And he came in. He wanted to cut my right arm off because I had gangrene in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't let him do it. And he got angry at me. They put two guards over me and left me. And I gave myself the last rites. And I thought I was going to die.
So he was in Gestapo-controlled farmhouse, and they told him he had gangrene. He knew he had an illness. He knew he was injured. Imagine that. So now there's a group in France called the French Resistance.
And all
who came to your, who came to your rescue at what point in this farmhouse? At what point did you become aware of someone helping you?
All of a sudden, I woke up and I saw three men walking in with pistols.
Oh.
And I thought there was a Gestapo coming to threaten me. And two of them walked in to where the two guards were, and I hear pop, pop. And the other guy came over and put his finger into my mouth, and I knew right away it was the Resistance. I kept my mouth shut, and he picked me up, put me in his car, and we drove off. And we had a firefight with the Germans. And
in the car?
Yeah, and I got hit right over here. And they must have hit the part of the car.
Yep.
And I got part of the car on the bullet that's still in here.
Wow. So here we go. Here's a true story of French Resistance, true Frenchmen coming to the aid of an American who they somehow got word of in a Gestapo farmhouse. And they had the cojones to come in there and save your life. And you're still talking to me today with your wife in the other room.
That's right. And
so that's amazing.
You got to give the French Resistance so much credit. A lot of people don't care for French people, but it's because Americans, they have a bad attitude sometimes when you go to different countries. But if you speak a little French to them, all you say is bonjour, and they love you. Love you. And these people here treated me like a son.
That is awesome.
Just like a son.
So, John, do you want to explain the story, or do you think people should read the book, or do you want to explain a little bit more?
I'll tell you quickly what they did.
Okay.
They took me to a French Jew doctor that had a clinic.
A clinic right, in France.
Right behind Reims Cathedral in Reims.
In Reims Cathedral, near Reims Cathedral, yep.
And I go visit him once in a while. And
he's safe in French Resistance hands, sort of.
And the owner was a Jew Frenchman, Jewish. And he came up, he says, my name is Dr. Levy, I'm going to try to save your life. He operated that morning, ran out of ether. Operated that afternoon, ran out of ether again. Now, he's worried about my arm. So he says, if he doesn't get enough ether for about an hour and a half operation, I'll have to amputate his arm.
Ether is pure alcohol used to neutralize infection.
No, what I did is get ether. It gave me ether.
Ether to inhale and put you out, like an anesthesia.
That's right.
Okay.
That's what they had. So the French went out and stole a net. I don't know how much ether they stole. They brought it back the next morning, gave it to the doctor, and he operated on me three times in 28 hours to save my life.
This operation was on the wound from the plane, your heels, your gangrene.
That's all they did. They saved the arm.
They saved your arm.
They put it in a cast.
Okay.
And when I woke up, that's what I looked for first. I looked for my arm, and my arm was in a cast.
Awesome.
You'll see a picture of it in my book, right?
Great.
And the other thing is, the ribs they couldn't do anything with. All they did was put a strap around you, and that's it. And I couldn't walk anyway, so they didn't bother with the ankles at all. They never did bother with them. So anyway.
So it was a long escape with the help of the French Resistance and their connections all through France and over the border into Spain.
Well, the thing is, quickly.
Yeah.
The the Germans had a good idea that I was working not only with the British, but I was working with Churchill's SOE, Special Operations Executive.
So John Katsaros here, the man sitting here talking to me, was sending crucial intelligence from France through the French resistance to British and the American intelligence agencies to aid in their invasions of Normandy and also other attacks in France against the Gestapo. And you can learn about all of this and more on JohnKatsaros.com. John Katsaros, The Long Escape.
Jake Katsaros 3.
You can email him at jkatsaros3@comcast.net, and all of this will be linked in the podcast description. John, thank you so much, and I will also do an article review of your book to give them more details on the escape in France, but I think we shared so much to get readers interested. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. You did a good job.
Thank you.
As an announcer.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.